It's up to me then. To improvise and wax on philosophically about incomprehensible topics for sport, I guess. Maybe for the benefit of a small handful of sentient beings. Yes, so the puzzle and curious paradox of what's referred to as self-realization is profoundly, if not exquisitely, simple. And yet, because the apparent shift from colloquial and self-referential consciousness to the what we refer to it as stridency of being is or appears to be, let's say, somewhat rare, even amongst ardent seekers. Our tendency then is to overcomplicate the affair and fill in the blanks with far too many philosophies and cosmologies and spiritualisms that claim to have some advantage with respect to articulating the nature of being or dynamic emptiness, when in fact they don't and can't. So our tendency is to become mired in and admiring of the, you know, New Age parlance or New Age celebrity or non-dual Neo-Advaita, Dzogchen, Kashmiri, Buddhist, yoga celebrity du jour, turning our validation-seeking attention toward them for knowledge or wisdom, how to statements of personal spiritual progress, and all kinds of memes of that kind. Hi.
Hey, how's it going?
Very good. Good to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
Yeah. I'm just kind of waxing non-philosophic, and then we can start some conversation if you'd like. So the irrefutable fact or texture of present experience is here, unbidden, without permission or preference of any kind. In a manner of speaking, we're actually held captive, you know, by our own lives. And in this curious atmosphere of, you know, sensual and emotive and psychological expression. We are naturally captivated by the curious nature of our own consciousness, and then presume that the allegations and accusations that are made by that consciousness belong to us. So we construct the world and our place, you know, in the world ephemerally. And then we hold it to be true and binding. And when we find discomfort and disquietude in our view of the world and our view of ourselves, then we might go a-seeking. I love to go a-wandering. Yeah. So we go a-seeking to get an answer or find an authority figure, a parental figure perhaps, someone or something that we can supplicate to ameliorate our suffering and confusion and circumstantial difficulties. So we're duped easily then by the Judeo-Christian myth and the Buddhist myth, the Hindu myth, the Mohammedan myth, etc., etc. And we turn our naive attention to the founders of these religions or to the supreme being that they espouse to know something about in hopes for an intervention, either through prayer, meditation, supplication, diet, and all other sorts of activities so that we can participate in securing a way of being or an eventful future that is pleasant and nourishing for us. And when things go well, from time to time, we may celebrate our relationship with the Supreme Being or the Supreme Teacher or Teachings. And if things don't go well, we may curse them or find the inner strength to continue to praise them, imagining that either we've done something wrong or awry in a present or past lifetime. And come up with a million kinds of justifications for why we're enjoying or not enjoying what we imagine to be our lives. And this whole while, we are accompanied, experiences accompanied by an absolute maniacal heretic that I call myself, that claims to have you know, meaningful insight, knowledge, or decisiveness as concerns what it is that's bothering me or not bothering me, and then what I can, should have, might well do in the future about everything that seems to be imposing upon me. And the symptoms that I'm laying out here, I think most everyone can kind of lean into. The thing that becomes, let's say, a little more challenging is to see this entire body of symptoms, physical, emotional, psychiatric, you know, worldview, circumstantial, atmospheric, climatic, political, and in every respect, merely being an expression or an outpouring of, let's say, profound forces of creative and expressive impulse that actually have nothing at all to do with us. For as long as we are party to, victims of, companions of narrative consciousness, colloquial self-referencing consciousness, then indeed we have a story about everything. insatiably, unstoppably. And it's the story that we have about everything insatiably and unstoppably that you could say contributes in large part to our suffering and discomfort, our existential vulnerability. So the remedy for that is not anything that you could possibly do about anything. The remedy for that is an alchemical, impersonal, you could say, process, an unfolding, if you will, as whatever this is, slowly or suddenly, startlingly, weans itself from the momentum and implication of colloquial and narrative consciousness and discovers the texture of irrefutability, the texture of being, as being, as being, as is, the soul, fully inclusive, completely impersonal, primary force. And if there's a shift in loyalty from self-referencing as an individual, as a creature, to not just an admirer, but becoming palpably immersed in the texture of being, well, then that miraculous process wipes clean the tapestry of time and space and self. And the world, if there were one, continues to play its perhaps tragic game of dice, as is its wont to do. But our condition is no longer subservient, secondary, or creaturefied. Our condition is now absolute. And with that absolutism, you could say one is released from the vagaries of self-interest and the vagaries of all that appears to conspire to delude and confuse us. So I'm hoping, perhaps naively, that that's a fairly simple and to-the-point exposition about the curious and miraculous nature of consciousness and some emphasis placed on shifting from what we would call the creature consciousness or creature orientation to something that is similarly just as present as a companion reality that has absolutely no confusion. It has no skin in the game of manifest consciousness. What can I say? More, of course. That never ends. If this perspective is found to be somewhat palatable, entertaining, or enjoyable, then you can use it to your advantage, let's say, in refusing and refuting the interventions of the oh-so-many priests, yogis, fakirs, gurus, and pundits that profess to give us information about how things are and how they could be once we apply ourselves, all of which is patently absurd. Which can leave you disturbingly naked, at least from a consciousness point of view. You can keep your clothes on, of course, or it could leave you liberatedly naked because there's no movement in one's imagination. There's no movement of one's so-called identity to pursue explanation or remedy for anything. If those of you that are watching, all 30 million of you, is it? 30,000, I'm sorry. All 30,000, if anyone would like to ask a question, I'll keep an eye on the chat room. And otherwise, my guest and I will probably talk things over, and you're certainly welcome to eavesdrop.
I have a question for you. We started talking about Robert Wright's, I brought up Robert Wright's book on evolutionary psychology.
Yes.
And you said that he had gotten it wrong.
Sounds like me.
I believe you stated. And I was just wondering if you could talk about your views about the evolutionary psychology. So you don't believe that some of the propensity that we have is because of the evolution of man?
Well, sure. You can say anything you want about anything you want. And so someone that has a background as a climatologist or, habitat, PhD, a physicist, a psychologist, psychiatrist, a yogi, a meditator, a knee surgeon, right, or a nutritionist, will have an idea. Now, so it doesn't make that idea necessarily wrong, but it doesn't make that idea necessarily right either. So any reference that occurs within the bounty of what we could call the Akashic record of human consciousness, human experience. Since you're the one holding the pencil and it's your paper and it's your party, you can cry if you want to. So you can draw any connection that you want from anything to anything. And if it sells a book, that's a, ka-ching. You invited seminars and workshops where you can make a living and meet interesting people, some of whom you might leave your wife for, some of whom you might not, then a ka-ching, take everything to the bank. But you see, once again, anything that's written, no matter who the scholar is written within, right, a limited context, an imaginary, projected context. So you can draw connections within the field of your imagination. And that's what we're doing all day long, is drawing conclusions or setting the pace and strategies for how to feel and how to think and how to think and how to feel about events that have already occurred, about which we can do nothing, events that are happening now, which we generally ignore completely, and then events that haven't yet occurred that we think we can intervene in, preemptively. So we live in a field of self-referential imagination. And all of the books and all of the religions and all of the politics and all of the industrialization and all of the exploitation of natural resources and the population explosion, including the gurus, the good ones and the shitty ones, are all in the same field. So that's that. In which case, rock on to one's heart's content, and get whatever mileage one can get from presuming the world to be the world in the manner in which you presume the world to be the world. So become a healer. Become, anything. Why not commit yourself to serve the interests and needs of other sentient beings according to your own natural gifts and proclivities? And you can do that with or without, religious baggage, psychological baggage, evolutionary baggage. That I, my bias is that perspective, could be applied, maybe ought to be applied to everything.
Not the evolutionary perspective, you mean?
No, the perspective of, like, go tell it on the mountain.
Okay.
Sure.
I guess it just, the evolutionary perspective, I can see where it logically can make sense in some circumstances.
Sure.
But it also then has no place for a creator or any type of
you can find design. Evolutionary speak across multiple disciplines that use the word, and some of them might have be creator centric, creator influenced, and some of them might not. Buddhism doesn't necessarily profess belief or insistence on a supreme being that the Judeo-Christians might refer to God. The Hindus refer to it as, Brahman, Parabrahman. The Buddhists are like emptiness, whose finest ambassador is, the Buddha. So they reify, the supreme being with a little twist on, vocabulary.
So when you meant that he's gotten it wrong, it's really you meant in general anyone who writes a book about a hypothesis of how they believe.
It's perfectly right, of course, to do so within a broader context where everything is imagined.
That they're just drawing those conclusions through imagination.
What else can we do? What else has anyone ever been able to do? If there were a fact of being, and let's say here it is, what explanation does it require? What did you or me or anyone do to lift a finger to be alive and to be a captive audience to being alive? Nothing that I recall. I don't remember I don't remember signing a document. Or being
saying I'll participate in this.
Yeah. Do you want rebirth? Oh, absolutely. And do you want this woman and this person to be your parents? No. Sorry. Too late. You paused. Down the chute. All kinds of New Agers will talk about, the soul. Which has ramifications, if you're suffering from PTSD and childhood difficulties and all kinds of other curious ways that humans impose suffering on other humans, then it might be handy for a while to have a soul, to do soul retrieval, to, regain your, let's say, egoic, right, or existential dignity so that you're not, suffering from various kinds of dysfunctional victimization and deferral and denial and avoidance and getting involved in serial relationships that are no good for you, right? I'm not pointing out to you. Any of us. I've been there. So, so that all of these, contributions to the field.
I wasn't taking it personally until you pointed it out.
No, didn't mean to. So all of these contributions to the field can be practical within the context of the life, of a, let's call it, suffering sentient being that might take advantage of these perspectives to mature, gain a broader perspective, discover what the nature of forgiveness might be, and go through practical shifts in psychology, somatics, and emotional and or spiritual perspectives that permits them to breathe more deeply. Yeah. So, this is, if having these conversations, for those very few that might like to have them, one hopes that not just to be, a jerk or to be intimidating or a badass or to take advantage of people's gullibility, but it's actually a vehicle for wellness. But it's for sure a different kind of wellness than the one that we might typically wish to pursue, as concerns being safe and being validated and being right and having the imagination of ourselves persist. So it's a healing for sure. It's just the fee's a little higher. Without the exchange of money. Yes, imagination of oneself.
So you think we're just imagining ourselves?
Absolutely. Not that whatever experience is not so. I mean, oftentimes certain, you know, people in the field will refer to this as a dream, like a dream. And that's okay. I mean, yeah, you can call it a dream or not a dream, and it's not really that important whether you do or not. Sometimes the analogy of a dream is useful because, you know, for humans, we have this waking, so-called waking state, and a sleeping state. And in the sleeping state, to make it simple, you have deep sleep where there might not be any recording of anything, and then you have the dreaming state. So when we wake up in the morning, we reflect upon the dreaming state and know for a fact that it was imagination only. We don't take the dreaming state as being palpably binding, somatically binding. It was just the fancy of the nature of dreaming.
Well, it could. Some people, though, take dreams as, and they do interpret dreams as...
You can interpret them, yes, but remember, if you're interpreting a dream, you have to bring the nuance of the dream into the so-called practicality of waking life.
Okay.
Right?
I see what you're saying.
Otherwise, it's like, hey, hey, hey. You don't know what the fuck is going on.
So if you're not kind of paralleling it with the waking world.
That's right. Okay. If you're not drawing it into context of the waking world, then you, what was it? So this tendency to, let's say, through dream interpretation or other interventions, draw parallels into the imagination of the waking life contributes to the appearance that the waking life is cogent, stable, secularly existent, and binding in some way.
I see.
But it's not.
Realer.
Yeah, more real. Yeah, realer. Right. So what I mean by imagination, there's so many ways you can speak about imagination. I mean, all of the arts and sciences and mathematics and the incredible pursuits and achievements of humanity on the way to extinction, you could say we're all, an expression of imagination, a kind of a channeling. You know, art, music, literature, right, sculpture, everything, including mathematics and science and the Fibonacci sequence and whoever architected the Great Pyramids or the Sphinx or Easter Island or, you know, mysterious bright icons all over the globe. So
aliens,
sure, ancient aliens, you know.
What's your take on aliens?
Sure, why not? Yeah, I mean, if they're buying. You know, we can meet at, Panera for a cup of coffee.
So do you think that our perception of our own imagination extends to...
Well, it extends everywhere. You know, what we might call well-adjusted people or extra-adjusted people have extra-adjusted, they have perceptions of aliens and, you know, non-specific beings and, you know, elementals of all kinds and parallel universes, and they may reach into your body with a can opener and pull out a tumor. You know, so there's all kinds of, let's just say, fantastic perspectives that to the extra-sensitive kind of person are, you know, just as real and binding as, you know, you and I might think a juicy hamburger is. But even in that context of whether it's, you know, common experience, I'm a commoner, or, you know, extrasensory experience, I would suggest are still fall all within the same realm. It's not that there's multiple realms, although there's probably countless realms of curious, subtlety and nuance and extrasensory experience within the one realm of experiencing, whether it's extraterrestrial or terrestrial.
So you think we are all participating in that one realm? Or we're all in our own individual realm?
Isn't it both? I mean, here, if there were, let's take the one realm perspective for a moment. Whatever it is that occurs in what you and I might refer to as experiencing, either ordinary or extraordinary, is all of the nature of the one realm. And within the nature of the one realm, well, at least on this so-called planet, if there were one, there's, by somebody's count, you know, 7.6 billion humans, God knows how many insects, or birds, all of which are perhaps fast declining, you know, with the advancement of climate disruption. So it's not a fictional idea that we're in the midst of a rapid and accelerating mass extinction of countless species. That's, I mean, to the extent anything's real, you could say that's scientifically, you know, validated.
So you would believe that the scientific validated concepts are not imaginary?
Well, context is what matters. You know, if you are a creature on a planet born of beloved parents that, you know, welcomed you solemnly into this beautiful world, then from there you are kind of forced to believe all kinds of things. Which might include the validity of science.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. But again, you know, it's contextual, right? Yeah. I mean, if you're perhaps a member of one of the last remaining Amazonian, you know, forest dwellers that don't have cell phones, that probably have seen aircraft fly overhead, but, you know, maybe they're sure or not sure what to make of it. But for, let's say, if there are any remaining, you know, sequestered indigenous cultures, what does science mean to them?
Yeah, that's an interesting thought.
Yeah. So, you know, science is an affair of imagination.
Well, science is their natural realm.
Okay, then that's their science, is the natural realm, the seasons and the temperature and the life and the river.
The plants and the...
Yes, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and, you know, and the way that they game and play and make music, how they make love, how they raise, you know, their young. Yeah.
I mean, there is, though, you'd have to say there is a general consensus of cause and effect, though, that we all experience.
I don't think so.
Really?
Well, in some respects, you can find plenty of evidence for that. But in some respects, not so much. And again, it depends on the, let's just say, the degree of meticulosity that you apply to the investigation.
Well, I mean, in my imagination, if I can't imagine, like, there's certain things that I have to do to stay alive. I have to eat to stay alive. If I don't eat, I'm going to die. Although...
You haven't tried it yet.
There are...
But I'm with you.
There are, what are those?
Breatharians.
What is the name again?
Breatharians,
that's right.
Yeah.
So, but more than
I'm a
like,
Ben and Jerry's Arian. Myself. Ben,
that's
Jerry,
great.
Ben, Jerry, that's who's on my altar.
That's great.
Yeah.
I love that. Breatharians, yes. But what I'm saying is that's not in my imagination. I mean, that's pretty much a fact. If people don't eat, they die.
Yes. I mean, it's fun in that you're not really sure.
But I guess if we're not really sure that we're really living, then what is dying?
Yeah, well, that's there.
Is that where you're going?
That's perfect. Yeah, without me having to, you know, emphasize it. Yeah, that's your own discovery. That's as useful as anything. Yeah, I mean, what are we really sure of? I mean, here's whatever presence is. Here's this. And this, curious, not that it's a destination or a location, is the real, let's say, or the best ambassador of the real we could possibly lay our finger on, is the, oh my God, the irrefutable nature of present experience. Now, how does this feel, the irrefutable nature of present experience, if you don't bring any presumptions along for the ride?
Isn't that rather difficult?
Well, no, only imaginarily difficult. I mean, here this is. And it's not insisting upon any sticky notes.
Yeah, but if you're in this building, you're...
But are you?
See, thinking, though, that the ceiling's not going to fall on you. So you have some presumptions of your...
Yeah, there's all kinds of presumptions, you know, that one has, let's say, when you enter a building hoping, promising, preferring that the roof's not going to fall in on you. The ceiling's not going to fall in on you. But see, that is an idea, isn't it? If you really go to the unadorned, immediate, naked of interpretation, sensuality of present experience, it's not saying anything. It's not loaded with presumption. I mean, this is right about here, right about now, is the miraculous and utter simplicity of self-realization, of the realm, the revelation of the realm, the one realm.
Be here now.
Okay, be here now. Yeah.
Sorry to quote Rhonda.
No, quote away. I love making fun of Rhonda.
Have you read his new book? I think it's out.
Thank God, no. I will not read Ron Duss's new book.
So it's not going to be on your agenda, okay.
Yeah. I'm sure it's a useless rehash of all of the shit that he's been philosophizing about for decades.
Thank God.
It will find, you know, the audience that he appeals to. Yeah. So, you see, in order to have, you know, write a book of that nature about whatever human experience is, or humanity is, or whatever spirituality is, or whoever Mean Karoli Baba was,
death, yeah.
or you know, the beautiful invitation of dying, is just poetic soliloquy. Which is nothing wrong with it. I mean, I hope he sells a lot of copies, and you know, enjoys more unearned notoriety. So we can, and often do, spend our spiritual life or our casual life embroiled, you know, in entertainment. And by doing so, avoid consciously or otherwise, ignore consciously or otherwise, the alchemy of present experience, the alchemy of being. Because we become enamored of and expectant of, desirous of, insistent upon, endless streaming of self-reference. And then
even if we're observing, we're self-referencing?
Well, you go to your own experience. Sometimes observing, perhaps, and these are curiously concomitant. Let's say during a day that's filled with self-reference and, you know, strategies and plans, likes and dislikes and inner dialogue or, you know, express dialogue. Even while all that's going on, right alongside it, underneath it, behind it, above it, before it, whatever, is perfect realization, perfect simplicity. It's not one or the other. You could say it's kind of a curious question of orientation. And even orientation is not quite the right word, because as the present nature and texture of experience makes itself palpably seen and palpably known, then what we might refer to as orientation lapses entirely.
Like during present experience?
Here's present experience. This is exactly it. But our tendency, our habit, is to follow the bouncing ball of self-referential presumption and accusation and anticipation and so-called becoming. How does what's happening to me relate to me? And if that habit, if you will, goes silent, and then present experience is no longer, may I say, relatable. It is, but it's no longer relatable or relational. And the is grander than grand can be. And that becomes an immersive, what your word, observation, without being really any observation. Because there's nothing to observe. And yet, the palette of what there is to perceive is miraculous, dynamic. But when the habit to interject the imagination of ourselves into the formula ceases, then you're left with what this has always been and never ceases to be, which you could say is exactly itself, which isn't saying much. And it doesn't need to.
And it is with or without you.
Yeah, with or without you. That's right. Like Bono tried to tell us.
Who?
Bono. With or without you.
Harry, I'm thinking you're quoting some big philosopher.
Bono. Master philosopher of the whatever century this is. With blue-tinted glasses. And temporary laryngitis.
I had lunch with my son after.
Oh,
so, yeah,
yes.
It was delightful.
That's awesome.
To reconnect with him. And I found out that he has decided to, went from physics to philosophy.
Wow.
Because he loves thinking about things, and he's so I'm very excited for him.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Good
he's
news.
Really excited about that.
Oh, glad you had a chance to break through that strange wall.
Yes. It's been wonderful. And
that's
to
nice.
Think that he's doing something that he loves in college. So.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Super duper.
Yeah. He'll be sitting around having philosophical. Maybe I'll bring him to the.
I'd be happy to take him on. He can shred me all he wants. I'm shreddable.
I doubt that. He's a very bright, bright young man, but I'm sure you'll give him a lot of things to question.
Well, you know, the nature of self-referencing is, in a sense, quite formidable by virtue of our familiarity with it, and that it seems to be kind of a default position for our attention. We're not taught how to attenuate attention to being, to the texture of present experience. We're taught how to attenuate attention to objects. From a subjective bias, namely I am. I am object, 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 object. Yeah. So, you know, you could say, oh, that's, you know, a survival skill. But that's dubious. Since, you know, we're all begets pretty much soon anyway. So it's not like, you know, growing the species to 7.6 billion with this glorious survival tool of referential and objective consciousness was a great survival tool in the long run.
That's really an interesting thought. You're right. I mean, if we were actually in this evolutionary psychology thing and we were actually evolving to...
Right.
We're actually evolving ourselves into extinction.
Yeah. I mean, the sheer numbers of our insatiable masticating and belching and farting, you know, methane being, and the exploitation of, you know, fossil fuels and strip mining and all the other, and plants and nitrogen and fertilizer and runoff and, you know, fracking, et cetera, has, you know, for sure set the stage for severe depopulation.
Hmm.
Right at our doorstep.
Do you think that, phrase this question, because at certain levels, I mean, as people, I mean, as far as like, I mean, like you is, but there's, do you think that there's certain levels of a person has to be to a certain IQ for them to think of subjects and to be in the present and be aware of their own consciousness?
Yeah, that's, yeah, sure. That's an interesting question. We can certainly discern, let's just say, scales of human behavior. Let's just say, simple persons, primitive persons, persons of letters and advanced scholarship and study and IQ. But even across the scale of IQ and accomplished practical engagement with the scholarship of the species, doesn't necessarily, you won't necessarily find a correlation between that and the capacity for autonomy. Yeah.
So even though you might be smarter than the average bear, that doesn't necessarily lead to the fact that you'll be also more evolved as far as...
Absolutely not. Sure, absolutely not. And, you know, if you evolved from Goldman Sachs' point of view, right, is one thing. Evolved from Jeff Bezos or Elon Musk's or the POTUS's point of view, you know, is all according to their, right, bias and expectation of what it means to win, right, at life.
Right.
To win at life.
That's what you're saying.
And someone, you know, in the Amazon that has, let's say, much less sophistication from a, right, complex societal point of view, might be more profoundly nourished and winning at life than, you know, persons of letters and science and philosophy could ever hope to be.
Agreed.
Right? And, you know, so then, you know, where do you put Ram Dass on that scale? You know, just south or north of the basic chimpanzee? I would say south.
I guess my wonder is, too, with him, is the correlation between all of the LSD he did with his stroke.
Oh, whether his stroke could have possibly been the result of frequent LSD use.
I'm just wondering if there is a correlation, I guess. I don't know if anyone else has thought about that. But.
Yeah, it's anybody's guess. The same thing with Terence McKenna, you know, whether his, you could say, frequent experimentation with all kinds of hallucinogens had anything to do with his dying from a brain tumor.
Now, do you believe that I don't understand how something, I guess, I'm not sure, I don't have a book yet, vocabulary for a lot of these things that are coming up.
Mm-hmm.
I don't understand how something external, like a hallucinogenic or peyote or whatever,
yes,
can enter the body and then have you actually have more of a spiritual experience.
Well, you could say a non-consensus experience. Calling it spiritual is, you know,
right.
That's after the fact.
It is non-consensus because you're not in...
extra consensus.
Extra, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So, but do you feel as though that deepens your experience?
Many people, not all, but many, and you know, have reported that entering into relationship with plant medicine or LSD, which is, you know, the improved living through chemistry, have had, you know, miraculous,
yeah,
life-changing openings of empathy and affection and the capacity to take a knee to the sacred. So those sound like positive outcomes. But not everyone that's taken those drugs, you know, have necessarily gone down, you know, a spiritual or contemplative or seeker's path.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess I'm not so sure about changing the chemistry of the brain to bring on. I mean, I don't judge people for who do it, and if they have...
If you have an appointment, you keep the appointment. If you don't, you don't. And so the way you feel about it is, you know, perfectly swell.
Yeah.
Though, who knows, you know, not that I'm encouraging it or discouraging it, you could change the way you feel about it.
If I tried it.
Or just because some little, you know, wisp of elemental, you know, passes through, hits you, or hits a gamma ray, and a gamma ray, and a gamma ray, and the next morning you're like, I got to take me some ayahuasca. You know, you don't know. But up till now, I certainly respect your, you know, position.
I did participate in a cacao ceremony and did have a little bit of a, like,
woo. Yeah.
Are you familiar with those? A cacao?
I have become lustful for chocolate, if that's what you mean.
This was a whole ceremony where we drank it.
Nice.
And there's supposed to be some,
sure,
like, effects, and it was interesting.
I bet. Any ceremony can be, even without, you know, introducing a brain-changing substance. Ceremony itself, if done, you know, under gifted guidance, is brain-changing.
Really?
Sure it is. I mean, here's present experience. If one gets kind of jiggy with present experience, it's going to shift brain chemistry.
What do you mean by that?
As one experiments with the texture of present experience and weans oneself effortlessly from the addiction of self-referencing, then the what we call awareness, who knows what awareness is, or who knows what consciousness is, and frankly, who knows what the brain is? Not too many people, if anyone. But we can say that there's a response of the somatic enterprise, the chemistry of being, the energy of being, the blood gases. There's a shift in the somatic enterprise as awareness attenuates to openness rather than accusation.
I mean, kind of like I have my own idea and don't try to change it, or like I'm thinking in a certain way and that's how I'm going to stay thinking.
In part, yeah. I mean,
so you're saying openness to new ideas and new concepts.
Yes, yes. Openness to not just new ideas, but openness to no ideas. Free from the engine of ideation. Free from the implication of ideation.
Of any idea.
That's absolutely. Yes. And isn't that, to be blunt about it, the actual reality? I mean, here's the actual reality. It I don't remember when it began. So far it hasn't appeared to, you know, stop. Maybe at night, you know, on a good night's sleep, you get a break from it. But boy, it pops right up, you know, with a frenzy. But in so-called present experience, though there, all you can find is present experience, but there's no particular present experience because it doesn't start or stop or have any duration. It's streaming. So this streaming of novelty, when there's, if one relaxes from responding to it or imposing upon it through ideation, then it opens. It blossoms. And the habit to grasp or to pace, to accuse, to strategize, becomes absolutely quiescent. And in a gesture of that quality of contemplation, being with, yeah, you could say the brain chemistry changes. Isn't present experience being what it wishes to be?
It's really not within your control.
I mean, that's a profound observation. There's a lot of people at this, you know, so-called church where we're sitting that would insist that it's all about intention and control and pacing and decisiveness and self-will. But they might be mistaken. It might have absolutely nothing at all to do with the myth and the mirth of control. So one takes a risk or a gamble to explore what experience, present experience, reveals when released from the habit, the reflex of control. I mean, aren't you living at the pleasure of this? You're not living because of self-will.
Yeah, I think you're right. You're living, you really have very little do with how you're living. I don't believe it's already chosen for you. I do believe that there are different levels, but it keeps adjusting. I'm having these kind of understanding that
sure. That
as we're going through, our path just isn't like the straight line that's already set. Our path goes and our path kind of moves in this, for me, it's looking like lines, like a map, kind of.
Yes, and to look at one's, let's say, path in that poetic manner is a little bit like we spoke about earlier, when you interpret a dream, you have to bring the dream back into some kind of context
right.
to be able to draw a painting of some kind. Yeah. So as much as that poetry is, you know, entertaining and fun and as true as it needs to be, yeah, there is no path.
Yeah, it's difficult because you have to, sometimes when you have these spiritual experiences, it's difficult to bring them into the context of your known experience.
The good ones can't be.
Yeah.
The good ones are discontinuous with the reference of, you know, the supposition of my life. Good spiritual experience is discontinuous.
You can't equate it to what you've known.
No, that's what makes it a good one. It cannot be equated.
Oh.
Yeah. I
guess it just feels like it should be in some sense. Like,
well,
like, I guess that's the whole idea of reference, though, right?
That's exactly right. If you try to turn spiritual experience, good, bad, or indifferent, into something that's now referential and relevant to the known, well, you've just killed it.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right.
That's right. You've inserted the imagination of yourself into the program, or you've co-opted the spiritual experience back into the hubris of self-reference.
Yeah.
Yeah. When good spiritual experience, as in right about now, is discontinuous.
Discontinuous. I'm not sure I follow that. What do you mean?
You're not dragging yourself along for the ride. The reference of self, the burden and the habit, the comfort and the nuisance of self is relaxed and released.
Of having to, okay, I see what you're saying.
So there's no clinging.
There's no clinging to, okay, I've had this experience and I need to.
Yeah, right. See, all of that is, that's an interjection.
Yeah, because you're having this experience and you're like, okay, I have to equate this to what I've already known.
No, right.
Yeah, you have to just accept it as something that kind of is unexplainable.
Well, yes, and when you look at it as a packet, namely a discernible experience that you might refer to or recollect as an event, that's also a kind of clinging or framing, because if I may be so, you're having that experience right now. This is discontinuous, and it doesn't have to be a parsable or uniquely identifiable spiritual experience.
Okay.
This is it.
It is what it is. Yeah.
Yeah, completely without, you as the companion. Present experience is empty of self. That's a fact. Even though we may clutter it up with self between now and the grave, while we're doing that, it is also unobscuredly empty of self. But sometimes it takes a glimpse of a kind of a peak moment, right, where you're really confronted with something that's not refrigerable. Meaning, right, not, can't be placed into context, shouldn't be placed into context. So, just for fun, imagine present experience, as in right about here and right about now, being exactly that. That you needn't place this into context. Then it becomes what it is, streaming mystery. Streaming euphoria.
Yeah, an idea, yeah.
Yeah. That's it. So all of this fuss about, you know, self-realization or enlightenment and all this crap, and then all of the methods and means to explain it, to justify it, how to get to it, what to do about it, to purify, to do prostrations, you know, to give the guru coconuts and flowers and all that horseshit. It becomes absurd.
It's pretty simple.
It is, like, frighteningly, liberatingly simple. Here this is. And if only we would just, pardon the phrase, shut the fuck up, then the euphoria that this is can reveal. But if I am doggedly and involuntarily consumed with interjecting myself into the miracle of present experience, well, I've got, let's just say, too much pride. suffering from too much pride.
So it's as if it's right before us, and we're just distracted by all of this.
Yes, this is exactly the entirety of the sacred. And then you could say its nature, because, you know, I didn't choose to do it. Its nature is to distract itself. So what we might refer to as anthropomorphization is perhaps an organic compound. It just comes with. But we can discover that what the nature of self-referencing actually is. We can trace it, sense it, feel it, see it, watch it operate. Look at the nature of time and space and implication, the mentation of self, the mentation of analogy, the mentation of strategy, which is psychological time. And as you unwind and are capable, willing, and have to be undefended, you have to be to some degree undefended,
because
otherwise your pride will just take you off into, you know, just absolute distraction. So if ever, during our curious life, we find ourselves capable, through magical means, to contemplate and consider the absolute unadorned nature of present experience, without pride, without defendedness, without pacing or anticipation, it can open, it can self-reveal. And then this becomes that miraculous spiritual experience, which we recall we had once, and it was too good to even think about. Here it is. Now, from this feeling tone, right, this is not a movement of mind. This is a feeling tone. This is a change in texture, a change in presence, a change in being with. So now the being with is soft, open, undefended, nothing to prove, nothing to validate. Here it is. Where is evolutionary biology in that context? There's no context for it.
Right. There's no... because...
yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Right? So absolute intelligence is the nature of reality. Your nature. Not that you're in possession of that nature. Right? Absolute intelligence is the nature of reality. And one can discover it and sense it. Be imbued by it or immersed in it. In really, really simple tones.
Do you think perhaps it's because we're kind of gotten on this treadmill and become like lemmings because we're just following what everyone else is doing, kind of?
Well, it's truly acausal. And so the lemmings metaphor is a good one. I'm all for it. But you can see right through it. When you apply naked intelligence to any metaphor, you see right through it. There's no because.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
Right? Present experience is acausal.
Well, what I'm saying, though, is we're not, I don't know if you can be taught to observe present experience. I guess that's what I was thinking.
Well, that's what I do.
You do? You teach how to observe?
I don't know if I teach. I'm a bold-faced liar, and I invite.
Right. So what I'm saying though is you're inviting people to at least acknowledge or consider this, but the remaining people out in the world are just caught up in this the I and the objects.
Yes. Yes.
That's what I'm saying, that yes. Many people just follow that because that seems to be the stream of where...
Well...
Do you see what I'm saying?
Yes, of course.
So do you think if more people were doing what we were doing, that there would be a shift?
Oh, that's fun. So from one point of view, if one were interested in, let's say, starting a movement, right, or starting a new religion.
Well, no, that's taking it kind of out of...
Well, or assisting sentient beings to suffer less.
Right.
Right? Then you can draw, you know, a useful conclusion like that one. But it's not, it ain't necessarily so, said Porgy. Or Bess.
It ain't necessarily so. No, it ain't necessarily so.
You can't throw in shit like that with you. We do tend to back ourselves in a corner sometimes.
It's not possible to measure. And okay. and therefore, looking at the culture, the species, the teachers, the teachings, who's interested, who's not, who has had exposure to it, whether it's had any impact on them, is impossible to say.
Yeah. No, you're right.
I mean, I've been, you know, having these conversations for 8 years now. And if they were at all good, I mean, I've enjoyed them. But if they were good in the way you're suggesting they were good, there'd be 20 or 30 people in this room.
I think it's just too uncomfortable. It's a very uncomfortable concept, and I used to be extremely uncomfortable
I'm with you, yes.
And I'm not exactly sure what made the change.
No, you can't know. It's not possible.
I guess I'm trying to equate that same idea thing. Okay, well, we must come up with an idea as to why now I'm not uncomfortable or as uncomfortable.
Hey, you know, the word grace can be used in a meaningful way in this context.
Without using I.
Absolutely, yeah.
Okay, right. So every time I'm referencing I, the ego is coming back in.
Well, that's the nature of reference, right? Referencing
so
an I.
How do you talk about your experience without referencing yourself?
Oh, well, you know, you have to take a little bit of a presumptuous risk to suggest something, let's say, a little bit bold, risky. Just to see how it lands in the, you know, whomever it is you're speaking with, how it lands in the listener. So what I do is, I'm not saying I'm particularly good at it, but what suits my personality and whatever level of understanding I'm either in possession of or not in possession of is to, you know, have the conversation in the way that I have it. More from a point of view of, you know, questioning or dismantling.
Yeah, but what I mean, though, is, like, within that sentence that you said, you referenced I a number of times.
Yeah.
So how do we, though, refer to our experiences and our...
In a sense, you could say any way you want, any way that pleases you, any way that sounds, you know, nice. Because nothing is, you know, particularly true. When you're emphasizing the nature of unadorned present experience or absolute intelligence, that is non-referential and trans-temporal, and not beleaguered by, let's say, spatial coordinates, is no longer a product of, you know, being a creature. Well, now the vocabulary, you know, has to change somewhat curiously.
Yes.
Because you're not speaking from the vantage point of I, or personification, or, you know, space-time or implication. You're winging it.
I don't know why I felt like saying this, but you're part of the entire
You want to get as solemnly close to the sacred nature of being as you possibly can.
And the closer you get to that, the closer you get to the source, I believe.
They're the same.
Okay.
I mean, this is the source.
Right.
There's nothing other than this. So it's not really like source and then
expression. You're merging in a sense.
Merging, maybe, you know, but then you could say better than merging.
You are already merged.
You're liquidated.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. Who wants to merge? No, there's no one or nothing that could possibly have any interest in merging with anything other than itself. Right? The one realm theory puts an end to, you know, merging. The primacy of being, the primacy of intelligence, without the word being or intelligence having to mean anything in particular.
I guess the concept that I was kind of under the belief is that we were part of this large thing and we've forgotten and we have to remember again.
It does the forgetting. It does the remembering. You're just collateral damage.
So it's not really the I that's choosing to remember.
No.
Okay.
No, there's no way.
Saying. I see what you're saying. Yeah. So it's all working without...
It's all working.
I'm just getting drug along.
Yeah, yeah.
The process.
It's all working, you know, for or against its own so-called self-interest.
Yeah. So then, therefore, though, because I don't really have a part in it, it wouldn't matter what my intelligence level was.
Interesting observation. Sure. Yeah. Right.
Okay.
Yeah. IQ. What we call IQ, from a relational point of view, may not be an important player in the capacity to stumble into being.
Mm-hmm. Stumble into being. Or stumble into not being.
That's right. Stumble into not being. Yeah. See how lucid your own vocabulary becomes when you don't have a focal point. You can go, yeah, stumble into being, stumble into not being. And you're perfectly happy with either one, because your fundamental lucidity is that of sacred intelligence. So you're not going to be pushed around by nomenclature.
And you're not bound to a certain...
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah. This is this. Say what you like. You know, in a conversation where you have the pleasure and the privilege of speaking with someone that... that is sufficiently undefended to explore this, the texture of being, in an undefended manner, in a sincere manner, you're already ahead of the game. The juice of intelligence, the juice of bodhicitta, is exactly this, and you discover it. And it's not mine. It's not based on vow or behavior. It's not based on cosmology or religious ideology or biological evolutionary biology or anything. It's absolutely autonomous. It's absolute. And you don't have you don't have a question about it. I mean, it's so absolute. No one can talk you into or out of anything.
Mm.
And by hanging out, lingering, even from time to time, lingering in the company of the absolute, one, you could say, naturally weans oneself from over-reliance or compulsive reliance on the mirth and myth of thinking.
Or indulging.
Yes.
I don't know, those Chick-fil-A...
Well... When it comes,
I was eating them the other day. I was in my car and I was going to text you. I wasn't sure if you were going to remember.
I would have raced down to wherever you were and, you know, picked up an order.
I guess that's the other step to where not only can we, I believe, I'm trying to equate it again to something I know. And
sure. Yes, equate it away.
Because that's the only way.
Mm-hmm.
But what my being, I guess, is feeling is if we can bask in that sense of being part of the oneness, of being part of I'm just thinking of energy.
Sure.
That energy. That
yes.
Eventually, if we're able to just bask there, that we will not have as many desires and those will fall away.
Well, maybe, maybe. You know, it would make sense that as one were to voluntarily or involuntarily immerse in the immediacy of being, the immediacy of unadorned consciousness, that is a gesture of simplicity.
Mm.
Yeah, and so, you know, the kinds of distractions or desires or ways that we thought we should investigate or invest in to fulfill ourselves, what could naturally fall away,
mm-hmm.
because fulfillingness becomes autonomous, no longer object event driven. But if you're still alive, you're still, you know, the meat, you're still, you know, at the pleasure of the biology. So when it comes to, you know, food and dress and relationships and, you know, amorous affection or platonic affection, rock on. I mean, you know, obviously quite a number of, let's call them, you know, highly regarded so-called spiritual figures got involved in, you know, unpleasant amorous affairs and unpleasant financial affairs and exploitation of, you know, naive and vulnerable persons, you know, with or without adult consent. I mean, our history is rife with it and ongoing. I mean, you know, so far there hasn't been, let's say, you know, a sexual exploitation of our dear friend Byron Katie, but in her, you know, enterprise, in her religion, you could say there's plenty of financial exploitation amongst consenting adults.
Now, is she the Circle of Miracles?
The work.
The work, okay. Byron Katie, okay.
Yeah.
Is that like S?
Well,
the work.
Interestingly enough, the work, you know, in, you could say is kind of its own thing, but if you look a little more carefully at it, you'll see that it is an amalgam of all kinds of things that came before it. And Werner Erhard's teachings are certainly deeply blended in to the work, as is, you know, 12-step and recovery intelligence, deeply blended into the work. So she was, you know, she was lucky. She came up with a methodology because we love methodology. And so...
It's just another distraction.
Another distraction. And she's also, you know, what's that word called when you've got whatever that... what's that? Sorry, I'm
I know what you're talking
yeah.
about.
So she has that, right? And so both she, you know, therefore accomplished...
Charisma?
Yes, thank you. She has very natural, you know, charisma. And she's a miracle worker at working with people's, you know, psychiatric issues.
Hmm.
Fearless.
Really?
So she's very entertaining in terms of watching her dismantle people, get over... you know, sometimes very serious life disappointments. You know, I mean, they could be casual and frivolous, or they could be, you know, abuse and, you know, more substantive, right?
Mm-hmm.
Life issues. So she's a masterful genius at her craft. But what happens is, because our tendency is to fetishize and objectify,
mm-hmm.
that one fetishizes her, as the spiritual celebrity, her condition as an enviable one, and her charismatic gifts and the work as that which is deserving of worship. Like Buddhists worship Buddhism. But Buddhism is nothing. I mean, throw together some Four Noble Truths and an Eightfold Path, 20 of these, 30 of these factors and those factors, and all of a sudden you're a fucking Buddhist nerd. And now what's important to you is the study and the practice and the repetition of Buddhism, and you've forgotten all about self-realization. I mean, you've forgotten completely about it.
That's so true.
Or you've made it...
You've become completely distracted.
You've become completely distracted.
The work to...
Yes.
Right. So the work itself to become enlightened has removed you further from enlightenment.
Everything does, because if there were enlightenment, and let's hope there is, it would be this absolute, autonomous, unadorned intelligence right here. It wouldn't be something that happens to you experientially or behaviorally in the future.
Mm.
Now that's quite a shift, because one then is soliciting, inviting, and hearkening one's intelligence to the presence, not to, right, the amelioration of psychiatric discomforts.
Or gathering additional...
Yes, no more tools.
Yeah.
Right, you don't need any tools.
I don't think I understood that when you first brought that concept about.
Uh-huh.
But I'm beginning to understand that a bit more.
Well, if this is sacred and this is autonomous and this is absolute, and indeed it is, and that can be discovered in ways that are inarticulatable, then truly and affectionately, everyone and everything can just fuck off. To me, that's a release worth paying for. And, you know, we do this for free.
Good place to be.
It's nice. Yeah. I mean, as deep existential nourishment pours in, which is the revelation of being. You see, no one can know anything.
Mm.
You glimpse firsthand the infallibility of this. And then, you know, as it deepens and fucks you up in the way it's quite capable of fucking you up, the imagination of your life and your living of that life is replaced by unadorned autonomy. And why shouldn't it be? I mean, if we don't interject distraction, nonsense, bullshit, celebrity, right, persona, personality, and charisma, if we just leave those, you know, off of the table, then here we are. And if anyone puts up a complaint or a question or an insistence, then you're like, of course you're absolutely welcome to any distraction which may be running your consciousness.
We're not going to rip that from you.
Yeah, right? No. I mean, if you need it, you got it.
Right.
If it's codependency, if it's fear of this and fear of that and retribution and angst here and victimization and this and that, you're like, pile it on.
Mm.
Yeah, bring it. But to see that it is a reflex, an involuntary reflex of hallucination, is both liberating and very devastating. I mean, I'm perhaps naive. I would think that, you know, folks would be really interested in this. Not me, because I'm an idiot. I'll disappoint you every day. As will we all. We'll just all disappoint each other all the time, because that's how that flies.
Not meaning to.
We're just, you know, we're distracted and selfish and frightened and preoccupied, and we're just going to disappoint each other because the undulation of needs and interests and affabilities is unsteady, is unstable. Mm-hmm. That's cool. But even in the midst of that instability, you can wake up. But it's not up to me, obviously, who participates in this conversation and who doesn't. It's never been. I mean, when I first started talking, I'm like...
So what makes you continue?
This is the most fun. Really, it is. Truly, it is. It's the most fun. The gift and privilege of hanging out with, say, fellow human beings and cultivating a dignified space. Not so easy to come by.
No, it's not. I find that I've been doing a lot of dog sitting lately, and I find that it's very nice to have the comfort of the animals. They don't seem to fuss as much.
Yeah. We, actually live quite simply. The narrative over complicates.
The shoulds and the
yes,
the I have to's and the
yeah,
and the I must, yeah, for yeah, all these reasons that
yeah,
we never signed up for.
That's right. And you see, we are indeed captive. Mm. I mean,
you mean we're held captive?
Yes, held captive by the urgency, the impulse field of orientation.
Mm.
Yeah.
And other people will hold us accountable too. Because it's like, what's wrong with you? Move along, get with the program.
Well, sure, yeah. Yes.
And God forbid you stay at the ATM in your car for a second longer than you need to.
Yeah, because Krishna's, playing his flute in your trunk or something. Is that Krishna?
I heard, actually, I read that that Krishna only played his flute until he was 16.
Did you listen to that Sadhguru thing?
No, on the email?
Email.
Was it where?
Oh, a friend sent me a so-called spiritual talk by the repugnantly posing Sadhguru.
That was on the email, right? That you sent out? Or where did you...
I'm not sure.
Where's the link? Okay.
Yeah, I don't remember.
Because sometimes I can't read your stuff on my phone.
Oh.
Because it's so small, and it's just difficult for me to read it, and my computer at home's not working very well.
Oh, so. Yeah, that's right. Yeah, that could be difficult to read on the phone. Yeah. Anyway, I was just referring to this talk that he gave, because I think it was Krishna's birthday or something.
Oh,
recently,
okay, no, I didn't realize that.
And said something about Krishna stopped playing the flute when he was 16, and I'm like, oh,
it might have been that. It might have been what you're talking about. Yeah, I don't remember where I got this information from, but perhaps it was that, because he talked all about Krishna and about how he gave the flute to his
Radha,
wife. Yeah,
and she played the flute.
Yeah, and he never played the flute again.
Right.
Yeah, we must be talking about the same thing.
Must be, yeah. It's not often you get a chance to hear about Krishna's flute playing.
Yes, I suppose.
But he continued to play the skin flute for many years thereafter. Okay. Well, you see, I mean, someone like Sadhguru is a great example of the childishness of Hinduism, of any religion. You know, the belief systems and the history and the celebration of so-called great and sacred beings and what they did and what they didn't do, and that you have insider knowledge because you've studied the Vedas or whatever. And I mean, this is just, you know, madness. This is just sheer egotism.
Yeah, I agree, because when I signed up, my yoga teacher training has really opened up a lot of things for me, and I'm very thankful for it. But during the time when I was taking the training, it just felt like spending all of that money and being so privileged. I just seem to find a problem in it, because there must be, I guess I was under the assumption that not just the privilege got to have peace. Mm-hmm. You know, there must be some other way instead of these avenues to acquire.
Yes.
Yes.
Yeah. Self-realization or whatever it portends is for the taking.
Yes. And I think when you start putting labels on it and making money off of it, like you said, say this is the way, this is the truth, and then having to pay for it, it's another distraction actually from the actual, and
smart business persons can use so-called spirituality or, you know, reminiscences about the life of Krishna as ways of enjoining, entertaining, seducing their audience. Mm. And keep that annuity coming in. Mm-hmm. And that's what most of us crave, is a certain kind of camaraderie based on repetition, ceremony, shared belief, shared history, you know, and the trivialities of objectified human consciousness. Mm-hmm. Because that's all we know. And so we find succor and belonging, tribal satisfaction in those things.
Well, do you think, though, that maybe perhaps people think that if someone has an idea that it is worth paying for, and perhaps since you're giving your ideas away for free, that people don't find value in it? So I'm sorry, they're just thinking is distorted.
I would imagine the thinking is distorted. Hmm. Yes. Hmm. Yeah. Right. I mean, I'm just because of the avenues that I travel to reinforce my own thirst and hunger for, you know, call it spiritual authenticity, right? Release understanding. That I couldn't do this any other way. And it's not under my control anyway.
I understand what you're saying.
But, you know, in a sense, out of affection, out of respect for, you know, the camaraderie of the, you know, human experience, that, you know, this is a kiva. It's, you know, it's a Native American story hour. It's an aborigine event under the stars, under the night sky. You know, this is the evening fire. This is for free. This is how human beings, I would say, at their best, enliven and enlighten each other. This is how the young would be taught in the company of, you know, adults being together and cultivating the nature of intelligence.
It would be so much nicer to have these meetings outside around fire.
Well, we do from time to time. Now that the temperature's gone down, we've probably had a few fires. That's my, you know, romanticization of why these conversations are valuable and essential, why I do them, why I would continue to do them.
Mm.
Yeah. You know, in the modern day, there's so many distractions and there's so much pollution, right? Psychic pollution, consciousness pollution. That this, you know, this is a way, an egalitarian manner, for no cost, with no vows and no board of directors and nothing, to come together and sip from the fountain of oneself.
Has anyone else chimed in?
There's some chatting going about. Nothing specific. You know, and it's not really an issue of, let's say, asking questions of, you know, an authority figure, because there's no authority. You know, this kind of discovery is aimed directly or indirectly at the dismantling of authority.
Mm.
I'm not bringing a religion to the table or a cosmology to the table. I'm doing my best not to. By looking at the nature of present experience, which is your present experience.
A thought just came to mind that you're oozing what is.
Aren't we? We are oozing what is. Yeah. And holding.
Do you think you can see other people's oozing?
Sure. Yeah. Of course. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. You know, if you, depending on how you're feeling inside and
yeah.
the nature of the gazing, you can, you know, you can see human beings that are, you know, showing, let's say, some symptoms of being present,
mm-hmm.
and human beings that are, you know, whisking through their day and their management of their work and their children and their tasks in a, you know, semi or unconscious manner.
Yeah. No, and yeah, you start to see that even by the way people are walking. I can watch
yes.
people, and you can watch people that they're just like almost mechanically.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, even if you stopped them and said something extremely profound, that they would just push you aside.
Yeah. And, you know, when you do healing work, whether it's, you know, yoga or bowls or anything, you know, half the battle there is to solicit unadorned attention. Because in the space of openness and unadorned attention, the vibration of the bowl or the vibration of the touch or the vibration of sound or whatever gets deeper into the system. And that harmonic, that vibration, you could say raises whatever consciousness might be primarily, and then cellular activity follows.
In addition. Yeah, this Sunday is the Healthy Living Festival at Snipes Farm.
Uh-huh.
Hopefully we'll have a nice day, so I'll put a plug in for that. Maybe you'll attend, because I know how much you love holistic fairs.
I'll be... up in the Poconos.
Oh, okay.
I've got tickets to go see Alanis Morissette.
Wow.
I know.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
I bet she's going to be awesome.
I hope so.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay.
I will be at her feet. Where everyone should be. Has concerns Alanis Morissette.
The prior mouse gapier.
Oh, yeah, was she?
Yes.
Oh, okay. Far out.
I believe so.
Maybe.
Don't quote me on that. Maybe look up that tidbit. I'm almost positive she wrote
that. Makes sense. Who knows? got to start somewhere.
I suppose, yeah. Although she went in quite different directions than Britney Spears, right?
Yes, right. Yeah.
Well, I think this was another, was she or not?
I think she was.
Yeah.
Yeah. Too much fun.
Oh, strange world reference, right?
They all are. Well, good. Thanks. You know, different nine.
Part of the time.
Thanks for joining us, folks. I hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. Post the recording on the website at some point, and I appreciate your support. See you.